what character formation is required for soul care professionals, people like therapists, pastors, or spiritual directors, and what might that mean for every one of us who seeks to follow Jesus? That is what we are talking about today. This is the Embodied Faith Podcast with Jeff and Sid Holzclaw, exploring a neuroscience-informed spiritual formation brought to you by Grassroots Christianity, which is seeking to grow faith for everyday people. Today, we are very excited to have Chuck DeGroat on the show with us. He is a professor of counseling and Christian spirituality, as well as the executive director of the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at Western Theological Seminary, which is in Holland, Michigan. And we're all actually in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not in the actual same physical place currently. But Chuck is also a licensed therapist, a spiritual director, author of several books, one of which you might have heard of, which is called When Narcissism Comes to Church, Healing Your Community from Emotional and Spiritual Abuse. And as a therapist, he is especially interested and concerned about issues of abuse and trauma, as well as pastoral and leadership health. Chuck, thank you so much for being on with us today.
Yeah, you guys, it's good to be with you. You didn't mention that you're going to be starting a Doctor of Ministry cohort with the seminary.
That's true.
That I teach at, which I'm very excited about.
Well,
we're excited about it too. Yeah.
Yep. Sid and I are launching DMIN, a doctoral ministry in relational neuroscience and spiritual formation, which we're very excited about. You can find all that in the show notes. So yes, Chuck was instrumental in kind of recruiting and asking us to do that. So we're all starting programs that are very interested in soul care, spiritual formation, the relational kind of neuroscience and everything that's teaching us. Mm-hmm. So you have been a pastor. You were trained to be a pastor, but then your life took a right turn. And then you became trained as a therapist. And you worked both as a pastor, as a therapist, and now you're in the academic world. You continue both all those hats. And so you really have a perspective on all these kind of all the things that are happening in the mental health world.
Yeah.
How it affects pastors, all of us, as well as, and this is what I'm really interested in for this conversation, as well as the training of therapists and counselors moving forward. So we're just going to mine all your expertise and ask you questions. So the one that piqued my interest, we were out to breakfast and you were talking about the values and you said, what I really want is to form the character of these counselors and therapists within the Christian soul care tradition, but you wanted to form the character and you mentioned the words hopeful and humble. And just before we press play, you mentioned that, and I think this is related, that therapists and counselors are gaining more power and influence in culture, but also in a sense over people. And maybe that's not the right alongside people, but power and influence. Like pastors 200 years ago, pastors were like the apex of influence, power, control of, hopefully in a mature and healthy way. But that's shifted for all sorts of reasons, which we don't have to get into. But now therapists are in that position. And I think you've felt like this is something to be shepherded. Like, how do we? So could you fill that in just a little bit? Like, what were your guiding principles for why you set up the program to focus on those things?
It really goes back to my own formation. When I was in seminary, I was a pretty arrogant seminary student. And it was the counseling program at the seminary that did its work on me. The primary professor in that program was also contemplatively formed in his own sort of past formation. He was a close friend of Brennan Manning. He brought in people like Gary Moon, David Benner. I got to be spiritually directed by Gerald May for a season. These were really important people in my own formation. And so here I was in my mid-20s, and the program itself invited me to take a good hard look at parts of my life that I hadn't looked at, parts of my story, my shadow side. It was incredibly humbling, the program that I went through, not least because I was in a complementarian space, and the vast majority of women in my program, people in my program were women, naming what they experienced from me in terms of my own, how I showed up, even my own misogyny. And to get to an answer to that, it's really connected to my own story and my own formation and the kind of formation that I've been able to be involved with in a couple of different churches that I've served at and now at the seminary for the last 10 years. And as we think about, and this gets to your point that you were making, Jeff, as we think about the formation of therapists, for this next generation. When I was being formed as a therapist, very few people in the church felt very good about therapy, right? There were a lot of critics. And here I was, an ordained minister, trying to invite people into these spaces of vulnerability, growth, change, transformation. And I was getting a ton of pushback the mid to late 90s. Today, a lot of people are talking about therapy and the importance of therapy and knowing their personality types and their Enneagram energy and all this stuff. And I think with that, therapists, particularly, and I've contributed to the conversation on narcissism and abuse in the church, but therapists have grown in their own voice and power, particularly as we name some of the big and real problems within the church. But a lot of the counseling programs, we can get more into this if you want to, don't develop the person of the therapist. Mm-hmm. They're taught personality theories, developmental psychopathology, things like this, oftentimes cognitive behavioral therapies, but not very often are they invited to do their own work. Maybe I should put it that way, right? And we're using the words humble and hopeful to name aspirationally what we long for in the character of therapists that we train, that we would realize as therapists our power. And we've got significant power. I realize this not just as a pastor, but as a therapist. Like, things I say to people behind closed doors, they take that and they run with that. So if we're talking about the possibility of separation or divorce, or we're using words like narcissism or abuse, there's immense power that we hold in the room to name things that become realities in people's lives, as Sid suggested before we started recording. And so those are some of the reasons why this is important to me.
Yeah. If you think about anybody who knows anybody who's going to therapy, it's very common for people to talk about, my therapist says that, or my therapist mm-hmm. thinks that I should, or my therapist told me to. And so what you're saying is so true, that therapists do have this power. We're going to people because we want help. We want someone to speak into our life. And you're right, there's incredible power. I feel that too, even just as a spiritual director and a coach. And as much right. as I try to stay out of the way and let people interact with God and evoke awareness and let the spirit be at work, there is still, I recognize that my words carry a lot of weight. Yeah. So I appreciate what you're talking about with this hopeful, with this needing to have people be shaped themselves. It makes me think about too, that in one of my coaching trainings in the power of embodied transformation is what the course was called, we learned that, and I wish I could quote the research. I don't know exactly where it is. I know it's there. But that when people experience the presence of another person, it's less about the skill or what they're saying, or the conversation, the content of the conversation, it's 80% the person and who the person is and how you That's feel right. in that person's presence. Yeah. And so what you're talking about, this shaping of the person, is 80% of what we're doing when we're with right. people. And so if yeah. we're neglecting that and we're just talking about content and skill and the sort of technique, we're missing the bulk of what people experience.
Yeah, as we're developing this clinical mental health counseling program, we've identified these values of relationally oriented, trauma-informed, and rooted in the Christian soul care tradition. And what you just named is that relational orientation, that interpersonal orientation, what happens in the room, what happens between people, which is very different than a more sort of cognitive behavioral orientation. Let me just help you change the beliefs, the lies that you're telling yourself, right? You actually have to be aware of what's happening within you if you engage in more interpersonal ways. And that means you've got to be doing your own work and you've got to be aware of your own shadow side. And so that's harder work. That's not work, by the way, that the insurance industry recognizes quite as much yeah. because it's longer term work.
Right.
But I think it gets at how we were created. We were created in and for relationship, right? And so we are in the, it's the orientation that I think we all share around a kind of relational and neurobiological approach to people, to human beings, that this is the way we heal. This is the way that we flourish in and through relationship. And so I'm excited about that part of it.
Yeah, that is exciting. I love hearing you say that, because I often am saying to people, Jeff and I say, when we're teaching in our attachment cohort, we often say, you didn't get these attachment wounds in a vacuum. These wounds right. came from being in community, like in your early yeah. formation, and the only way they yes. heal is through being in relationship. Yeah.
your earliest school of formation was your home, right? Were your parents, your caregivers. And so that means that how we conceive of formation in a seminary Master of Divinity program and a counseling program is very important. And as you guys teach, those attachments show up in all different kinds of ways.
Right.
And so as we invite 24 students into this, who knows how it will show up and the work that we'll need to do with one another. But that's the fun of it. There's not just like a curriculum that we download into people's brains. It's a work we do together.
Yeah. So when you're talking about helping people do their work or look at their shadow side, one, and this is like really, this is terrible. So here's my shadow side coming out. Like part of me is relieved. I'm like, oh, I was trained as a pastor at a seminary, and we get a lot of people rightfully criticize the personal formation of pastors. We learn the Bible, we learn theology, we learn church practice, but like that soul care or that formation of the individual oftentimes is lacking. And then secretly, I was like, so that happens to therapists too? I'm so relieved. So anyway, all to say, we live in the West where we're very cognitive, idea bound, and we think better ideas will change everything. And that's clearly, that's not the case. But yes, so that's my show.
Although, although I sense that shifting generationally, I think that like people in their 20s and 30s have less respect for the ideas and more respect for the people who've done their work.
Yeah, for sure.
I will say though, Jeff, in my PhD program, which was filled with therapists, I'd been in some very unhealthy, sort of misogynistic male spaces in previous sort of ecclesial spaces that I occupied. It may have been the unhealthiest space that I've been in that PhD program that I went through in psychology with other therapists who, by and large, hadn't done their work. I was stunned when they'd said they had never been in therapy themselves. Wow. That's very dangerous.
That makes me think of when Richard Rohr said, if we don't transform our pain, we will surely transmit it. And what a scary place to be transmitting pain when you're supposed to be in a position where you're, the other person is supposed to be healing from their pain and you're unconsciously transmitting your own. That's pretty scary.
And pastors do that too, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this idea that a therapist at the highest levels would never have gone to therapy. So I suppose that speaks to maybe the humble kind of word there. Could you fill that out a little bit more? What are you hoping that people will be able to receive or live into so that then they can offer it when you use that word humble? Like, what are they, what's happening in them? Or
I think as we do the work, we encounter places of weakness, of challenge. As you're sitting with another person, if you've never experienced some sense of, I don't know where to go right now, then see a therapist. I remember experiencing that, and ours was a highly relational program that I went through back in the day, something that we're trying to model here. And I sat with co-therapists, and we would debrief often afterwards, and there would be this sense of, I had no idea what to do after the first seven to 10 minutes, where to go, what questions to ask, what are we doing here anyway? What's our vision for flourishing? There are all kinds of questions. And I think a lot of times those are swept under the rug as students are given competencies, right? Here are techniques. Here's a modality. Here are particular questions to ask. And I think we were invited in my own formational process. We were invited into those very questions. Like those are the very questions that will allow you to see the portal through which you'll do your own work. And for me, recognizing that I had come from an MDiv world where I had a lot of the answers. Now I was stepping into a room where those answers were not satisfying. Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't going to download the very thing that I learned in my systematic theology class the hour before, maybe, or the day before, right? But I was to sit, I was to listen, I was to attend and attune at a different level. And I had no idea what that meant, even attune, pay attention, and just give me the answers and let me download. Yeah. That seems easy. And there's work for us to do as we personally and individually recognize places in which where we need to grow.
Yeah.
Does that make
Absolutely. Sense? Absolutely. It does to me. That's been instrumental in training as spiritual directors and as coaches too, of just the, like one of the things that when I'm training others in spiritual direction or coaching, I'm always saying like the most important place to start is you've got to stay open to what God is doing in you.
Yeah.
Like as you're seeking to be trained to come alongside others and help them notice what God is doing in them, don't forget that God is doing stuff in you all along the way and constantly being noticing what's going on in me during this conversation and where do I feel convicted and struggled and confused and challenged. And
So I know Sid does this as a coach and spiritual director. When she gets to that in a meeting, she gets to that, I don't have the next brilliant question or the next to-do list that will help them move this forward. But I know, at least I hear, Sid then it becomes more of like a prophetic or a spiritual insight moment where you tell me what you think, Sid. She just listens, where do you want to go next? And just wait. And I don't know, is there a component like that in your, since this is a Christian program, is there like components like that where you will be in humility asking students as a therapeutic resource, ask the Spirit of God what to do? Is that something or is that not something for you guys?
Yeah, but with that too, not in a techniquey way either, right? Like you first have to get to those places in your own life where not just sitting with another, but in your own life, we've all come to those places where we get to a place where it's, I don't know where to go, what to do. I've hit a wall. There's something underneath that feels desperate, even chaotic. Where do I go? How do I engage that? Do I just double down and get back in control? Or do I listen more deeply to what's going on in those subterranean layers, right? And all of us are invited to do that kind of work. And I think when we're in the room, sometimes, in fact, with clients, I can tell you some of the best moments have been when I get to a place where I say out loud, I'm not sure where to go next. How are you feeling the same stuckness that I'm feeling? And there's this sort of, and oftentimes we recognize that we were trying really hard. And the reality is that people are not problems to be solved, right? And sometimes we treat people like that, right? That like we're in some sort of detective movie, right? And we're trying to find the answer to the puzzle, the answer to the riddle, right? People aren't riddles. They're not problems to be solved. They're mysteries, image-bearing mysteries to be engaged at a personal and relational level with a lot of patience. And that's where humility comes in, I think, Jeff, right? I'm a bit embarrassed that I think early on in particular, I used words to describe what was going on in people, even diagnoses that I felt like I had a high degree of certainty about. And now I'm ashamed that I said these things out loud, right? But I was a fairly young therapist and pastor, and despite my formation, I had this sense that I need to call this what it is in the moment, right? Or I need to place a label on what's going on. And this work, I think maybe both of you in doing the work as pastor, spiritual director, you'd probably agree that it takes years for us to die to those pathways of probably neural pathways of certainty and control that we live out of, right?
Yeah.
I think that stating out loud, I don't know what to do next, is so powerful. One, because it speaks to your own work of humility and then being able to rest in uncertainty. And if you're feeling stuck with somebody, it's because both cognitively, but also viscerally or in the embodied limbic resonance or whatever, like you're all feeling stuck. Like we're all stuck together now because whatever you were sharing, I don't know how to process that. And whatever it brought up in me because of what you shared, I don't know. So we're all stuck. But saying that out loud, having the humility, but also the courage to say that out loud, it does this wonderful thing to the person who hears it, who then can be like, you can say that out loud. You're allowed to say, I don't know what comes next. And then it's like it's a secret. Like we just shared this secret. It's okay to say, I don't know what to do now. And then we can both just not know together. And then you shared online a little bit ago that you work with pastors. And you tell me if this is true in some therapeutic worlds of people who never apologize, pastors who never will say, I am sorry that I did that, or I said that, or I was wrong, whether it's a content information thing, or whether it's I acted poorly. And I think that's another, the humility kind of markers. It's just being able to say that was wrong. I did. And then, either
there's these layers of what psychic defenses, right? Survival defenses, you might say. Your friend Jim Wilder wrote the book, The Enemy Mode, right? There are these ways, in large part because of our stories of formation, right? That we may not even be conscious of, that keep us guarded and protected. And in that kind of enemy mode, I don't want to apologize. I don't want to acknowledge that, right? that we need to become aware of. I entered my counseling program in that very mode, and I put up more defenses as my counseling professors were trying to invite me to take them down. I felt very insecure. I felt very vulnerable. I wondered what's going to happen if I move toward vulnerability, if I take down those walls that I've used to protect me. And yeah, it's the work of being human, being vulnerable. And it's that's why I think when we use words like humble, hopeful, we are trying to invite an imagination for a different way of being with one another that rejects these pathways of certain and control and diagnosis and all the things that I think give us a false sense of power as therapists, spiritual directors, pastors, and caretakers of the soul.
Yeah. So about that second word then, hopeful, because we were talking about being humble, creating that space of uncertainty. What are you hoping to get into people out of accenting like this hopeful aspect?
It's interesting. You mentioned this, the narcissism book that I wrote, right? And I did a podcast recently with some pastors who said, we hadn't read your book, because we just assumed that it was a takedown of clergy pastors, right? And then we read it and we realized, oh no, you are just trying to define the landscape and offer honest words for what's going on. And we didn't realize that you're a pastor and you're very hopeful about the work of pastors and the work of the church. And the reality is that I think in a day where there is this massive reckoning going on. Like Phyllis Tickle said that years ago in the Great Emergence, that every 500 years, there's this rummage sale. There's this massive reckoning. It was the Reformation. Now we're in a time of reckoning again. It's very easy to say, all pastors are bad and all, maybe even all spiritual directors, because somehow you're still connected to that system, that tradition that abused me. And actually, we're wanting to train women and men to enter into the church with hope, right? To be the prophets, priests, and kings, right? Who are honest, who create spaces of vulnerability where people can know and be known. We're not looking to tear things down. We're looking to be honest in our work. We're going to name abuse where we see it. I think counselors are a unique place to see systemic issues as well, not just in families, but in institutions. We're going to name these things, but we're not going to do it for the sake of tearing the whole thing down. And so I think that I'm excited about seeing what that means. When we use words like this, we use them aspirationally. Now, obviously, as women and men participate in this program, they're coming with their stories of pain, right? And they're going to come to us with, I don't feel much hope. I see lots of clients in spaces like this. Chuck, you want me to be hopeful, but I'm not experiencing a whole lot of hope. Okay. I'm not here to change your mind on that, but I do hope that the work we do, and I've long had this hope within me that the work I do is not just about tearing down. The first book I wrote was called Leaving Egypt, Finding God in the Wilderness Places. And part of what I said in that is that in this work that we do, we can leave people in the wilderness and say the wilderness is the destination. And no, actually, we've got to go through the wilderness to get to the promised land, to get to the land of hope. And so will we be able to walk with people to these places of hope in their own lives and for the sake of the church?
No. I was just reading a book on the entangled brain and how our emotions and—
Of course you were,
Jeff. Yeah, of course I was. But they were talking about losing fear of phobias, this author. And what he was saying, he says, the science says that you don't unlearn a fear. You just learn something else. And that made me think we're always moving forward as people. And moving forward has to be some sort of constructive goal or hope or purpose or destination that you're moving toward. Because you don't just let go of the past. And if you've read any habit-forming books, they always say this. You can't just stop a bad habit. You have to actually start a new habit. And this is the same thing, is you can't just let go of a hopeless situation. You actually have to move toward something else. And I think a lot of times, we can, and pastors do the same thing. We just call it sin instead of trauma, or like it's that bad thing we're trying to leave. And we're always focused on not doing that thing or getting over the past or fixing that pain and unlocking it. And that's all true to an extent. But I think most of the relational neuroscience is saying, like, in community, you have to be putting on something new. And of course, Paul always said this, right? Put on Christ. Put off the old self, put on Christ. We're always moving forward. So I just, when you said that you wanted to cultivate hope in therapists, I was just like, oh, I love that. I just love that. Instead of looking at all these things. Go ahead, Sid.
Yeah. And even if I work with people a lot about, you can't change what happened to you, you can't change the past, but you can change the story you tell about it. So I'm even just thinking about sometimes that hope comes from just being able to talk about it differently and tell a different story about what the place is for that in your life and how you will carry that going forward. And that's a lot of what people do when they're in therapy too, is I've got to learn to tell a different story because this story is not one that I can live in. Yeah.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I find it really helpful, even as we talk about trauma, to say that trauma is not what happens to you, but what happens within, right? You were abused. It manifests with this imprint of trauma. And we can do the work of moving toward being more rooted and grounded in love, centered in our window of tolerance, navigating out of those sympathetics and the dorsal fog that we find ourselves in to a place of steadiness, center, home, that window of tolerance. And from that place, I think from that connected place where we are rooted and grounded in love, something happens. We become more compassionate, creative, curious, hopeful, energized by the spirit for this kind of this work that I think we're all called to do. But that's not manufactured, right? And people have to do the work of identifying the trauma, navigating out of the storms within, discerning the story they're telling themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us know in the work that we do, that's not easy. So we're not looking to spiritually bypass here. We're not looking for like simple band-aids, quick truth bombs over Twitter. We're looking to do the work of forming women and men for depth, for hope, for love, for faith. And so I'm excited about that work. I love doing this. You do a lot of this too, Sid, I know. And I often find I'm quite jealous of your husband, by the way, and his brilliant mind. I do find myself more at home in the messiness of people's lives. And I often love feeling overwhelmed and not knowing where we're going, like just being in the dark with a client and wondering, okay, there's nothing, not a whole lot I can do. I've got resources. We really do need to trust in the dark right now. Those are some of the happiest moments for me when I get to be invited into people's lives. And now I realize we're going to be stewarding the lives of 24 counseling students in this program now on that same journey. So yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Super exciting. That is really exciting. So who can apply to your program? Do they have to have a bachelor's in psychology or like who are you?
An accredited bachelor's degree. Yeah, an accredited bachelor's degree, but it doesn't need to be in psychology. I'd say people who are discerning a call to this kind of work and who have a bachelor's degree should check it out. I think it's valuable to have done your own work at some point. Now, there will be people applying who are 22, 23 years old and people who are applying who are 62, 63 years old. And sometimes there are folks who have done more work at 23 than 63 and vice versa, right? And so I do think that we're looking for people who are intrigued by this kind of vision. If you're coming in for just give me the pat answers so that I can go and fix people, we're probably not the program for you. Not only that, it's not a two-year program, but it's a three-year program, which allows us to do more of that formational work. Also allows the program to be more accessible to people who may need to work full-time or people in minoritized populations who just don't have the cash on hand to invest in a two-year program and go all in for a full load. And so we're trying to create the program, even by virtue of the three-year program that provides a lot of space to do this interior work, which is, by the way, the work of the Christian soul care tradition, not simply the domain of the psychological tradition that started in the late 19th century.
So I wanted to ask about that because you were talking about being relationally oriented and trauma-informed, but then also situated in the Christian soul care tradition. Could you say just briefly what that is?
Yeah. It's just to say people were asking these questions and having these conversations and interested in what goes on in people's hearts, lives, stories, long before the advent of modern psychology. And I often go all the way back to St. Augustine, the first autobiographer who wrote his story in meticulous detail in 9 chapters. And the 10th began with the words, Noverum me, noverum te, let me know myself, let me know you, O God. And many others. My great hero in the Christian tradition is St. Teresa of Avila, who I think is the greatest 16th century reformer. And her Interior Castle is a work of self-knowledge. It's a proto-developmental psychology even. And so we're going to tap into these deep resources of the church before the contemporary language of disorder. Early desert mothers and fathers were talking about the disorders of the soul and created a taxonomy, an early sort of psychopathology. And so we're going to talk about that early taxonomy and how it connects to our contemporary ways of understanding what goes on within. And so there's a lot to be mined there.
Yeah.
Great. Wow. I want to join the program. I just want to go to school for the rest of my life, forever and ever.
So what a lot of people would think of as like the spiritual formation tradition, the monastic writing or the ascetics, as well as the mystics. And so you're calling all that.
Yeah.
I really like that you call it the soul care tradition, because that is, because psychology is just like the study of the soul, right? That's what those words mean.
That's right.
And I was always like, you didn't theology in the Bible, haven't we been doing that way before the modern discipline of psychology?
So yeah, so search me and know me, oh God.
Exactly. So I love that. So thank you so much for taking some time to be on today. I'm like, we should do this more often. And I'll have all the information in the show notes for people who are interested, or maybe listeners know people who would be interested. Please forward this on to them, because then Western would be very excited.
Thanks for leading a D-min for us, you two. I'm so excited about it. People are so interested in it. They can't believe we're like hosting a topic like that, that they can study these things with you two.
I was Andrew Arndt. I was talking on his podcast last week, and he said, it's like Western is the Hogwarts of like seminary. They have all these really cool programs. That's what he wrote me. So
yeah, that's
I don't
great.
Know if that's a good endorsement or a bad one, but yeah, we're really excited about Western.
I love it.
About you. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to do that.
Just appreciate you guys. Yeah.
All right. Where can people find you or find what you're up to and the things you've written and are doing?
Yeah, here at Western or at Chuck. And then I'm on the kind of typical social media sites, TikTok. I haven't figured that out.
You can let your daughters teach you. All those will be in the show notes, as well as the new program that you're starting. Thank you, everyone, for listening or watching. If you're on YouTube, and please share and subscribe and do all those fun things to get the word out about this. Thanks again, Chuck, for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you guys, great to be with you.